And you gonna murder this one and murder that one. Talking all that bullshit. I'm gonna put it to you like this, yo.
This is for the nerds. This is for the brainiacs. This is what we deserve. Go ahead and play it back. You ain't gonna touch me. You're not gonna do nothing. You are not above me. I bet you wish you was me. I know that I know.
What's up, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of the Only Friends podcast. We have a very special guest in studio today. We're joined by the one and only Matt Savage, WPT Executive Tour Director. Got that right, man.
Man, nailed it.
Good job.
Love it.
Nailed it. You know, I was just thinking about this. This has nothing to do with anything we're going to talk about today, but you gave me one of my very first interviews ever. I don't know if you remember this.
Sure, I do.
2011. So 2010, I went deep in the main event. That was my first ever interview and it was horrible. 2011, I got like 13th or 14th in LAPC and then shot up to Bay 101 and I was deep in that as well. And I don't know if you remember this or not, but Lane Flack and I were at a table together and he was not sober.
Hard to believe.
And he was not happy with my play at all.
He was mad at you.
So we were bickering. Like, he was mad that I was raising it. Whatever. It was just the old school, new school thing. I was the young punk kid who was, like, way too aggressive. And we were at war. And I eventually ended up busting him on the stone bubble. He bubbled.
Wow.
And you pulled me aside to do an interview. I'm going to find it somewhere on YouTube. It's this, like, grainy-ass 2011 interview.
It might be on my YouTube page, which I never use.
But well, with gold like that, I mean.
With that and Pat Lyons,
I think it's probably time to revisit it.
Absolutely.
But yeah, that was a great event. These two events are now dead.
It is. Well, we're talking to them again.
Okay.
It'll come back. They're actually doing an event this year to try and see how it'll go. But I believe it'll come back next year.
Okay, that's great to hear. And
is this it?
No, this is Jess Wellman. This is another WPT stop. This was at Legends at the bike. I somehow chip led that for 2 days also and didn't win it. I was good at WPTs for like 1 year. Never won anything.
You got to come back.
Never good.
Let's get him back.
I think so.
Well, you got to get this West Coast back involved. So you just wrapped up LAPC. What year is this? 25th or something? You guys have been going for a long time.
I'm not there anymore. I've been there since
LAPC.
Since WPT left?
Yeah.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's gone.
Okay, so that explains why it all went downhill.
Yeah.
I heard I never got to play LAPC. Like the good one.
It used to be remarkable.
Played the bad one.
It was the sickest 10K freeze out of the year behind the World Series main.
Yeah,
like, it was a freeze out.
Yeah, it was 10K freeze out. You could register up to I think sometime day two-ish.
Yeah, the beginning of day two, and hundreds of satellite winners, which was just the best.
It was wildly soft. There were here when Dan and I were living together. We would always go play it, but it was always like begrudgingly because it was too good a value to miss. But nobody wants to be in LA.
Yeah, nobody wanted to be there. So I miss it. I miss LA. I miss the players there. Believe it or not.
Do you?
Yeah, which is crazy. Yeah.
That is crazy to me.
You know, you spend enough time with them and, you know, they become your friends.
You stare at the abyss and it stares back.
Exactly.
I had a few deep runs in LAPC. There was 1 year. It might have been one of the last years I played it. Actually, it was the last year I played it. I ended up getting seventh. It was the year Deoxy won it.
Mm-hmm.
I know.
Young man.
Fucking Deoxy.
I was out there with you
young
for that.
Fan.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Blasted his chips off at the final table.
Yeah. I'm sure you remember this, though. He had a bunch of chips the whole way through, and I can't remember what it was that he was doing, but we had to call you over. I think he was stalling. We had to call you over to the table at least a dozen times because he was just doing his young man shtick. And it was so insufferable to sit through.
He still appears once in a while. I don't know where
he angled me in Austin.
Oh, good.
I
believe it.
In a 2-5 game.
Yeah.
We went all in on the turn. Dealer burns and rips off the river, and I win. And I had pushed out some chips like on the turn to signal all in. I set all in. The dealer clarified all in. He called and everything else. And then he tried to just pay off the chips that were pushed. It was a meetup game, by the way. Like, I'm playing a 2-5 meetup game.
Wow.
And I was like, no, I've known you way too fucking long. Give me those goddamn chips.
I love it.
Yeah, he's a special breed. Okay, so
Berkey with hair. Look at that.
Check this out.
Yeah, man. This is the vlogging days. This is the very first vlog we did.
This is when you.
Yeah.
What did you call with like Ace High here or something like that?
Yeah, versus Dietrich.
Yeah, yeah.
I called with Ace Jack High. I think he had 9-10 of hearts. Got his ass.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that was fun. That was our very first vlog. We were in it for a year. Can't do that anymore because LAPC's dead. Bay 101's dead.
Bay 101's coming back, I think.
Okay.
And hopefully somewhere in LA.
Yeah.
Oh. So we'll see.
Oh, a little
teaser.
Okay. Mm. And Legends is no longer WPT also?
Legends is not as of now.
No. Okay. Man, just as of California.
California.
Falling right into the water, isn't it?
Yeah. And I remember one podcast 2 years ago, you said that that's just because WP was charging $1 million for an event or something.
Somebody told me.
I remember that. It's not true.
Somebody told me.
I always want to get on here to clarify. Not $1 million.
Not $1 million. I heard $500K. But
no, it's not that either.
That was
somewhere in between.
Somewhere in between. I can't remember who was telling me that, but I do vividly remember that. I feel like it was somehow attached to the Venetian. But anyway,
Classic says something that may or may not be true.
That's right.
I made it up.
I did not make it up. I was repeating.
I remember you saying you're not a news source. This was recent too.
That's right. I'm definitely not a news source.
It came to me in a dream.
Yeah, WPT has changed a lot in the last 10 years.
Absolutely. I think, you know, I'm one of the few mainstays along with Adam Pliska, and you know, we've really changed, but I think in a good way. I think we've done a lot of good things to make the tour a lot more successful and a lot more, you know, prestigious over the years.
Do you think that has been a byproduct of like the audience that is best served by the WPT, or do you think it's the actual locations? Because it really went from the coast to kind of like inward to a lot of these Midwest. I mean, with the exception, I would say, of you're heading to Thunder Valley tomorrow. That's one of the few remaining California ones that you have.
Yeah, we're going to Thunder Valley tomorrow, and we have the Voyage coming up, of course. And we're really more of a global tour now. We have a lot more events around the world. They may not be the biggest buy-ins, and not all of our main tours. We just announced Macau this morning as well.
Really?
So we're going back to Macau, which it's been a while. So I did the first ever tournament in Macau a long time ago. I went to another gaming board and got a poker tournament approved there many, many years ago. So excited about going back to Macau.
What casino would that be at?
I don't know. I didn't even get a chance to finish reading the press release. It just came out. Okay.
All right. Well,
check that out.
Somewhere in Macau.
Yes.
Be on the lookout. I've never been.
Just be there.
I've never been. I've heard great things. No. It's so far, man.
It is far.
It's so far.
You get to go to Hong Kong when you're there too. So it's,
yeah,
you should go.
Yeah. I mean, well, bring back Aussie Million somehow. I know you have nothing to do with it, but
I did.
Okay.
In the early 2000s, I was there 3 years in a row. It was working for Fox Sports Net back in the day.
Yeah, if you could twist their arms. I can be convinced to go to Australia, and once I'm over there, you can take me wherever you want.
All right.
Africa, Japan, China, whatever.
Cambodia.
Like, I'm already there.
You know? It's just in Japan. If you haven't heard, the poker scene in Japan is wild.
It's booming.
It's so wild.
Do they have tournaments in?
They don't really have tournaments. They're kind of like in private clubs, and they play for no money, and they're so passionate and take it so serious.
This is something
they love the
incredible.
Game. They love the game.
This There's is
over
something
500 poker clubs in Tokyo.
Shota was telling us about this. He's not kidding. Like
Shota the Koto.
It's not that they play like, you know, on an app with play chips and then they pay out after. No, they legitimately play free poker.
It's like Zynga.
Yes. Yeah. Well, yeah, like the whole country is just like playing Zynga, trying to accumulate like points.
People play like League of Legends there for free and just like grind that. So it makes sense to me. They just want to win. They just play to. They play games to win.
Very competitive. Yeah. A lot of gamble in them, which I appreciate. You know, anybody who's willing to mix it up, big fan of mine.
Big fish.
I'm a big fan of theirs, I should say. That son of a bitch.
Shout out to Masato. He's really doing amazing.
Love
work.
Masato.
Like he just was a vlogger that came here, vlogged stuff, and then kind of helped start the poker wave.
He was booming in Japan already, I believe.
Yeah.
I think he had like 7-figure.
Like we go to clubs there maybe and play stuff or?
I think like his vlog took off in Japan, and if I'm not mistaken, he reached like 1 million followers pretty quickly. I don't know if like Japanese YouTube is different than ours or if it's segregated somehow on the regular YouTube, but I know that he just crushes the vlog game. And honestly, like if you've ever gotten to play with him, I get it. He's such a nice, personable kid.
Yeah. He made a deep run in the main a couple years ago too.
Yeah, I think you're right.
He went deep in our championship over at the Wynn as well. So it's always good when he's there. Literally, we have a whole country watch.
How different has it become where, you know, all the major WPT stops before, they were all 10Ks, they all brought out the same 200 faces, and it was full-blown TV production. Yeah. Now it's like massive fields for 3500s where 1% of them are going to be filming themselves and putting it out to, you know, an audience in the six figures.
It's definitely changed. It's, you know, it's, I loved going to places like Florida where I walk into the room and I only know 50% of the people, where I used to know literally 90% of the people that were playing these events. So it's definitely changed a lot, but you know, I think it's for the better. I mean, so many new people coming into the game still now.
Yeah. And I think that's probably true too, with the Prime kind of taking off the way that
Prime as well. And you know, our club WPT product really does really good for us. You know, they send a lot of players to these events, and it's not who you'd expect to be at these events.
Exactly who I expect. Yeah. Matt, I don't know if you're aware of our audience, but they're all Prime members, buddy.
Oh, are they?
I'm telling you, they're out there in the mix. Yeah, like, you know, for me, I hate tournaments. I'm on record as saying this. They broke my heart enough, okay? And I've had my fill. But I will say, I think what tournament poker does for the game as a whole, like as an industry, is really incredible from a growth standpoint. And I also think that it's the easiest way to bridge the gap between the people who have like been around for a long time and have made it and kind of graduated out of certain stakes. Like, I'm very rarely, if ever, going to go play 5-10 again. But under the right circumstances, you're going to catch me in 1100. You know, I'm going to play the Prime Championship at the Wynn. I'm going to play some, you know, a $1 million mystery bounty 1K buy-in. Like, I like to gamble too.
You'll max it, but
I'll be
there.
A wreck. Yeah, I'll max late reg, but I'll be there. And I think that that's kind of important because I think D-Negs is like in a class of his own. He's kind of unique, and he's the last of a dying breed where I don't think we're going to see the next generation of MTT guys out there like grinding the mid-ish stakes. You know, the Jason Koons and such, they're just in this class where they're untouchable. They're playing Tritons, they're playing all these big buy-ins, and you're just never really going to brush elbows unless you win a collection of satellites to get you involved.
I think, you know, you see that. Especially with the thing like we just had the World Championship, it's nice to have a good mix of different people, and I think that's why you play them, you know, because they're not just all the top pros.
Yeah, the value is obviously clearly there, but also, you know, I think like for people who have bucket list items and stuff like that, it's nice to know that you can go brush elbows with a Daniel Negreanu or someone like that in a 3500, and then also have a chance to win 3 or 4 million, which is. What a world we live in, man.
Yeah, it's like you can't, I mean, you're not going to win $1 million in a 5-10 game, but in 1100, you might, right? Yeah. Like the field sizes are just so huge now that, like, you know.
Yeah.
It lends to, like, massive, massive prize pools.
Don't try to drag me back in, Tortoise.
Come on.
I'm not.
The water's warm, Burke.
I'm not hearing this.
A lot of fish out there.
Talk to me about.
You play mostly cash anyways, bro.
Only until the summer.
Yeah.
Right, listen, I play both. Like, oh, you studying tournaments? Right? Like, no, I'm going to save that for 2 weeks for the series.
Yeah,
that's okay. Not what I said.
He can only, you know, compartmentalize so much. Okay, he's a hybrid tortoise. He's half turtle, half tortoise.
Not what he said. It's what he meant.
Right. All right. Let's talk about the WPT voyage and how this idea came to be and what you guys project it to be moving forward.
Literally, I turned on Twitter one day when it used to be called Twitter. And I saw that Adam Pliska was hanging out with Richard Branson.
Okay, it's a good start.
On an island.
Yeah, and yeah, it's a great start.
The next thing I know, we had a poker room on the Virgin Voyages that goes year-round.
Okay.
WPT at Sea. And the next thing I know that Warren Woodall came to me and said, hey, we're going to do a full ship takeover of an entire ship. And, you know, I thought, wow, that's, you know, I've been on a lot of poker cruises over my days, but I've never yet been on this one. So he sent us down there to check it out. I went on it, and it's not like your normal cruise ship, to be honest. A lot, it's a 18 and over,
yeah.
Which, you know, on the few cruises I've been on before, there was always a lot of kids on it. There are none on this, which is cool.
There's brats out of here.
There's restaurants are amazing. There's not even a buffet like you're used to seeing, but you can get plenty of food and things like that. So it's definitely there. The pajama party was kind of more of a lingerie party. There was some crazy stuff going on. So I liked it. I thought it was a lot different then it's not your grandparents' cruise ship.
Okay, there's some things.
I just bought some new lingerie, so.
Yeah? You get the tassels with it?
Yeah.
Oh, that's good. We'll keep you under wraps.
He's cooking.
Okay, there's a little bit to unpack here that I've been on one cruise in my life. It was a wedding cruise, and the wedding aspect of it was amazing, but the cruise ship itself, I think it was a Carnival cruise, left a lot to be desired.
Yes.
You know, it was basically like walking into the Golden Nugget. A lot of old carpet, you know, weird event centers, and wasn't a lot going on outside of the pool. For this one, you know, it sounds as though, listening to what Landon said as well as what you said, it's a lot more state of the art. There's a lot more entertainment packed in. What is the impetus behind taking over the entire boat? So this is just poker players, top to bottom.
Just poker players. For me, I see it as kind of a one big satellite, you know? Mm-hmm. A lot of people that are getting on there are getting their way through satellites, through Club WPT, but also, you know, promotions and different things, and just more recreational players than anything. And I think if you're going to play a tournament to get your name on the Mike Sexton Champions Cup, this might just be the one.
Well,
it's going to be a small field. It's going to be a nice field.
Yeah.
I'm not going to say it's going to be, we'll say, going to be a soft
field. I'll be in there.
Parky's in there, so it's soft.
It's going to be literally the best chance ever to get your name on that cup. And I think, you know, in respect, that does bring a lot of other things. There's, you know, we're going to Thunder Valley next week. If you are on the Mike Sexton Champions Cup, we have a steak dinner, and you get, you know, room deals, and you get in the VIP lounge during the championship. So to go out there and win that, I think would be pretty big. And of course, we're going to be covering it. We have you guys coming out there. We're trying to get Joey on the boat. Poker.org will be there. We'll have some poker news representation. So it's going to be a big deal. Whoever wins this thing is going to be a well-known poker player. So I think more and more we're getting people to come on it, and you know, still a little bit of time left to sign up, but I know there's still some rooms available.
So with regards to the sign up aspect, let's walk through that a little bit so you know people have a better understanding. First of all, if you guys are interested in more details, you can just hit hashtag voyage in the chat. It'll take you to a link to give you all the details for signing up, or you know, basically anything that you may have a little bit of interest in. Was that a concern of your guys's that, you know, there's a lot of poker players are notoriously lazy, first of all, right? We're last minute. And the thing is, like, if I want to go to Hard Rock Holly the very last second to go play a 3,500, I can take a flight that day, get there mid-afternoon, figure out my situation afterwards through an Airbnb or whatever, crash on someone's couch, and be fine. With a cruise, it feels like there's a lot of planning involved. Now, to be fair, having gone through this process now myself, there really isn't. It's kind of as easy as booking a hotel.
Yeah.
But I know personally, like, there is a certain barrier that I would have to cross in order to make the leap of faith to do this. Was that a concern that you guys had whenever it became, let's go on a ship and do this? Or like, how are you packaging this to kind of, like, appeal to the recreational?
It was for me. I feel like there's, you know, I knew all along that people would be calling me this week, as they are, and saying, hey, I want to go on this, so how do I get on? You know, that type of thing. I knew that was going to happen. So, like I said, Warren Woodall, who's heading up this entire project, along with Kurt McPhail, have made it super easy. You just go to WPTVoyage.com, or like you said, do hashtag voyage from yours. You sign up, you pay, and then they give you, like, a code, and you go onto the app, and basically put all of that in. I'm sure you've done that already.
Yep.
It's pretty easy. You know, you put your passport in there, your information, you show up and get on the ship. And that's, I think, people don't understand how easy it is. There is some concern about people thinking, oh my gosh, it's a ship. You know, what could happen? It's literally safer than anything else you do on a day-to-day basis, including driving a car.
Yeah.
They've come a long way since the Titanic.
Yeah. Yeah. Driving a car, getting on an airplane. I feel much more comfortable on a ship. And I always say that Richard Branson, you know, he's sending people to space safely.
Right.
So, of course, he's going to get this right.
Yeah, I don't think that's much of a concern. What about the details as far as like loading up your account so that you have buy-ins for the tournaments?
This is one of the greatest parts about it, is that you can get your money in through a bunch of different ways, including wiring your money in, or you can use a credit card, which my friends are all excited about because they can put some points on those cards.
And sure.
You can take up to $3,000 every day on your account and play cash if you want to do that, or enter the tournament. You can even enter the main event with the $5,000. through your credit card. And so you're racking up those points. And the way it works is at the end, if you've won, they'll give you the cash or they'll give you the money. If you've lost, they will just take it off your credit card and you get like a pre-authorization. So you don't really know until the end, you know, what you've won or what you've lost, but you can track it. You can just go down to the front desk and do that as well. And, you know, anything you do, you have what's called the band, WPTVoyage.theband, and you just swipe your thing to sign in for a tournament or even to get it a cash game. You just swipe your wristband and they'll bring you chips to the table.
That's amazing.
It comes right off your credit card and get into your hotel room, to go to the restaurants, all of those things. All you need is that band that's on your wrist, and if you lose it, they give you a new one. So it's pretty simple, really easy, and you know, I think the people are going to be more excited about going again after they've been this first time.
Is that kind of the plan? If this is a proof of concept, and if there's a good enough turnout and positive enough feedback, then this is going to become a routine?
Absolutely. I think we'll do something, you know, try and do this at least once a year. We have a great relationship with Virgin Voyages and Adams. Now friendly with Richard Branson and goes to Necker Island with him. So I think that there's a relationship there. And, you know, we are trying to do more high-end things, as you see, with our world championship and this voyage and some of the properties and places around the world we're going. And with the new owners, I think that they're focused on making us, you know, bigger and bigger every year.
Let's talk a little bit about the actual time on the ship then before we get into the schedule. So it runs from March 31st to April 6th. So it's a 7-day cruise. Of those 7 days, we're at sea for 4 of them. Is that correct?
More probably like 4.5 days. We'd have 2 full days in port. We're going to go first day to Grand Cayman. If you've not been to Grand Cayman, it is one of my favorite islands down there in the Caribbean. I've been to the other ones and not as big a fan as I am of the Grand Cayman. A lot to do. We have the pickleball tournament with Vince. We have the tennis with Tony. Lynn's going to be floating around the island doing different things. I'm running a golf tournament at the Ritz, which is an unbelievable golf course. So still spots left in that, I believe, a couple. And there's just a lot to do there. And then we go to get to Bimini, where we have a beach club, which was a Virgin Voyages beach club. And we're going to have DJs, and there's pools and ocean there as well. It's going to be really a kick-ass event. So I'm just excited that they've chosen Virgin Voyages as their partner, and we're excited about the World Poker Tour.
And when it's at port, we're not gambling then. We're enjoying port, ourselves.
You cannot gamble.
Okay.
You cannot play poker, but there is definitely a very full schedule when we're not. Like 20 tournaments from buy-ins from $100 up to $25,000. You have that high roller, a 10K, the WPT Prime 1100, and then the 5K main event.
So that's where my question comes in. Okay, so looking at this schedule, there are some marquee events. You just mentioned the super high roller for $25K, the high roller 10K, the main is a 5K. I believe there's a $1,100 Prime, as well as an $1,100 mystery bounty, and then a few others, including satellites. When are you going to run all of these?
Yeah, basically it's wire to wire. We have so many tables strewn across the whole ship, and we'll have all of that information of where you can go to play in those events. But we have a nightly every day. You know, like I said, the golf tournament, we have a poker tournament attached to it. So pretty much anytime we are not at a port, mm-hmm. we will be playing poker, playing tournaments, playing cash games, and the rake on that cash games is something that's unheard of. It's just $5,
10% up to $5. $5,
yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, it
can't seems really find that anywhere in the world right now.
And very, very much not the trend for cruise ships.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's quite the opposite. Usually you go to a cruise and you're just getting raked over the coals in games that are unbeatable. But yeah, this is quite the opposite. It's very player friendly, as best I can tell. You did mention the first night there's going to be a meetup game. So I assume this is when we're leaving port from Miami initially.
Yes.
8 to 11.
In pajamas. Don't forget that.
I see pajamas. I'm probably going to opt out on the PJs. I don't even know what I'm supposed to wear for pajamas. This might count.
Yeah, that'll probably work. If you wear that to bed, that'll work.
Sure. Sure. Guaba will be there in, you know, full blown lingerie. So
yes. Mm-hmm. Indeed.
No real concerns there. I was told the pajama parties get a little out of hand. I'm expecting it to be a little less so with all poker players.
I believe so.
Unless, you know, there's a
Guapo's in there.
Special friends being brought. Are you bringing anybody, Guap?
No, it's just myself.
Why are you sure? There's room for a plus one.
All right. I'll think about it.
All right. What other activities and entertainment are on board? Is there a pickleball court on board?
That's all I need to know. Not a pickleball court on board, but there is a basketball court.
Okay, that's
and
fine.
You can convert that into a pickleball.
Yeah, wow.
And there's other things going on. There's the Scarlet Party, so you definitely need to bring something red.
Sure.
If you haven't put that in your suitcase yet, you need to do that. And that's another party that they have on there. With the DJs, we have comedians, not only, you know, some great comedians, but also some poker comedians are coming on there as well. Clayton Fletcher, I don't know if you know him.
I know Clayton, yep.
Yeah, he's going to be doing a couple shows for us, trying to get Ben Ludlow to do some as well.
Nice. Ben's great. Yeah,
yeah, it's going to be fun. I'm excited, you know, just to kind of do something that I haven't done in a while. I haven't been on a poker cruise in a while, but I'm excited for this one because I think it's going to be a little bit different than what people expect.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like a lot. I'm still trying to wrap my head around how all these events are going to play out. It just seems like a lot. Are they running simultaneously? Like, will the Prime be running alongside the main?
Yeah, the Prime will be running early on. We have two turbo flights. So actually, the early flights are going to be the ones that are going to be the turbos.
Mm-hmm.
Generally, those are the last ones, the last chance to get in. But because we only have a short amount of time that night, we have to do those turbo the first couple, and then the longer one will be later. And I think that most of the people that win their way in through the satellites on WPT Global and Club WPT will be playing in that last one. But
yeah.
I think, you know, for the most part, the best thing to do is to get your way through on one of those early ones and then just hang out and party the rest of the time.
So is it one
play
of those
events and stuff like that?
Is it one of those things where the events overlap such that you can't play everything?
Yeah, you can't really play everything, but as long as you make it through on one of those other flights for the Prime, you can definitely play a lot of different events. Like I said, there's a nightly every day, and there's mixed games. There's all kinds of tournaments going.
Okay. I mean, fine. Fine.
You got to play some.
Well, I'm not going to have a choice. There I mean, go. Once it turns night, it's either play or socialize, and lesser of two evils at that point, Matt, you know?
You're pretty social.
Yeah, that's a.
You're not gonna hit up the clubs, Burke. You're not gonna be like yeah, raging.
That's the first thing.
Like, he's gonna yeah,
do. The gym there is nice.
Well,
right, fist pumping,
glow sticks.
Is that gym 24/7?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, maybe I'll get lost in the gym in the evening. All right. Well, I think that is a very well put together selling point for WPT Voyage Cruise. Let's solve tournaments. I got a lot to say, and I don't even play them, so I mean my opinion matters more than everybody else's. Let's start with something we disagree on.
Okay.
The big blind ante.
Okay,
you believe that if somebody has one blind left, let's say, it should be ante first.
That's the correct way. Yes, I believe that. Well, I do believe that, yes.
I kind of baited you into that. Okay, well, let's dig into that a little bit. It's correct because they free-rolled the ante for the previous eight
correct.
Hands, correct?
Right.
Okay, but...
And not only that, you should talk about this, but this is a new strategy that, mm-hmm. that many
leaving a chip
are,
behind.
They're leaving a chip behind.
Correct, yeah.
Which is a strategy. Is it annoying? Which is it?
It's a strategy
that's also annoying.
That's a little bit annoying. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
But it's definitely a strategy. Okay. So my counter to that's the correct way, though I see your point. I believe what you're saying is correct. There's also no form of no limit hold'em where there's no big blind.
Okay.
So wouldn't the big blind take precedence over the ante?
No, because ante technically means before. The word is actually means before.
Okay. Now you're getting into linguistics.
No, well, and... I'm not a linguist, but I will tell you this.
We'll talk about ante
you
means.
Do win all the ante the rest of the time. So
correct.
Why would you not win it when you're out of it? If you wanted to go the other way, you could do it where if you were short in the other spots, you could win the big blind, but not the ante.
I like that. I think I saw Dan Zak mention
right.
something along those lines. I think that's good. But I do agree with the overall conversation. I just wanted to nitpick a little bit.
But here's also the bottom line. I don't really care that much.
Right. Neither do I.
And honestly, I tried last time we had a TDA summit coming up again in June 29th and 30th at the Poker Go Studio. But I will give it another shot. If we can get everybody to do it the same, that what to me is way more important than being right about.
Because you are right.
Yeah, because I am right.
But oh, right. Okay.
But it's way more important to get everybody doing it the same.
Okay. So that's what I actually agree with. My impetus here is that I always think it's player friendly, I suppose, to give them a shot to
short stack friendly.
Yeah, yeah, it's yeah.
Not friendly to the other eight players at the table.
No, fair, but everybody should get an equal opportunity to be in the situation. So you kind of always want to give the opportunity to have the chip in the chair story, I think. But anyway, that's neither here nor there, because again,
more for regs most of the time. Yeah,
yeah, and it's just opinion based. But the point is, what I do agree with is uniformly having this similar to what we did with initially the first card off the deck, which is now last card off the deck.
Yeah,
and that's uniform as far as I know.
Well, a couple places were holding out, and I think that maybe even
Burnham at the stake
still holds out. And I don't, you know, again, that was another one of those things that got into a massive argument with your friend Daniel Negreanu, and he came in there and just lambasted one of our people on the board about it.
Daniel?
Yeah,
no.
Yeah.
He's such a reasonable, level-headed human being who never says mean things.
I love Daniel, but he was out of line that day.
Shocking.
For sure.
Yeah, I'm shocked.
And, you know, it's fine. I mean, I understand he has a reason for it. You know, he's got a lot of fans. He's signing autographs when he's playing, and he needs to be there, you know, doing that and be able to get there to the last card. That was his argument. And, you know, it was the argument of some others. I didn't care that much again. I kind of got saddled with it since I am a founder of the WPT and of the TDA and of the chairman of the board type of deal, that it was my idea. And many people think that...
like re-entries. You're ruining the game, Matt.
I caved on that. But to me, again, the most important thing is that everybody's doing the same.
Yeah, I mean, I will say in that instance, it's not even necessarily the courtesy that you extend to the players, which I do think is helpful, but it's also you take a lot of pressure off the dealers if you make it last card instead of first. Just in the sense of nobody likes a dealer who's nitpicking these like casual rules that like don't have to be so heavily enforced. You know what I mean? Like at the end of the day, if somebody's like reaching for their chair as the last card comes off, if you're one of the guys at the table who are like, nah, 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 you know, it's like, what are we doing here?
Yeah, that happens still to this day.
Sure.
Again, first card actually made that easier because you knew you weren't there for your first
card. Yeah, yeah, there was no judgment to make, but it was also like a heavy amount of burden, I think, on the dealers because they're the ones who take the venom from the player, especially if it's somebody like Negreanu. Right. Like, you don't want to get undressed by D-Negs. You know what I mean? Like, a lot of dealers are probably just going to be like happy to be dealing to him or... a little bit starstruck, and then the next thing you know, you're just getting berated because you missed the first car off or whatever.
We had legitimate arguments on Twitter about that back in the day. It just seems so stupid. It's
everything.
It's fine.
You know, okay, so like going with trying to find a way to make these things a little bit more uniform, it does sound like that's the direction the TDA, or at least that's what the summit's purpose tends to be, is to simplify things, give players a little bit of consistency, let them know ahead of time what they're showing up for. We talk a lot about this. Why aren't prize pools, or sorry, why aren't prize structures kind of up on this discussion of continuity?
They have to have been talked about at some point.
It's always talked about, but it could never be something like, hey, I'm with the WPT, you're with the WSOP, we're going to force you to use what we do.
And, yeah.
You know, in some respects, they want to do their own thing. And like you said yesterday, every TD wants to have their own little thing that they do.
They all want their little fingerprint on these things.
They fingerprint on this thing. But for me, I would love it. And, you know, I would love to have a standard payout. The problem is you have, you know, 40 player fields and you have 10,000 player fields. And you really can't make it something that uniform when you have that. And you have big buy-ins where you don't want the bubble to be four, you know, buy-ins if it's a small field. That type of thing. So it really becomes a question of if we can make something that's better. And I'm working on that now. We have a new calculator coming up for the World Poker Tour. We're going to roll it out at Thunder Valley coming up. And I'm excited about it. I think it's going to be a little different than what anybody's ever seen. It has basically double your the buy-in amount for the bottom spot. So if it's a 500 plus 50, you get 1,000 for the bottom spot. The pay jumps are bigger, but there's less of them. And I know you talked about yesterday, Landon, because you said that, you know, you went 20, 30, 40, 50, maybe even 100 spots where you made 40 extra dollars in some of these things. Now you're not going to have that. So you're going to have more bubbles throughout. And I know that might bring out some people to say, well, we need to, you know, go hand for hand again, but we don't want to do that. But just bigger jumps, and the deeper you get, the more money you will get, you know, 3X for certain levels, 5x for certain levels. And it's a different, just a different way of looking at it. And with that, along that lines, we have at eight tables, we will have balanced table payouts, meaning that if there was eight tables of people in the money, the pay jump would be at 63 because all the tables would be even. That's something they do in Europe already. So we're adding that to that. And of course, first place not being as big because you just can't do it when you're doing these things. And, you know, I think that's one of the things I've fought through my career because I've always tried to make payouts flatter. I want people to make more money. I want recreational players to come in the money because they can come back the next year and say, yeah, I cashed last year and I'm going to be back. So I think that's important for me. And I think that, you know, this new calculator will be good. And hopefully, I'm hoping that the WPT will just allow anybody to use it. And if we do that, maybe, you know, more and more people do use it. And we can, you know, make something a little more standard like you're looking for.
Yeah, because I guess something that we can see in the high roller scene, call it like the Tritons and the Poker Go, is like the payout structures are very clean. Like the bubble makes sense and then the ladders from there on make sense, but they're smaller fields, right? So there's obviously going to be a difference between a 1,000-person field and a 100-person field, but making those like different percentage pay jumps and ladders is not that difficult, I imagine.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, to my own fault, I believe that, you know, for the WPT Prime Championship that we just had at the Wynn, we did have that. We had a lot of, you know, the bottom payout was, you know, I think it was $1,800 for an $1,100 buy-in, and then the pay jumps were like
19, 2K, 2,100.
And then when you got to the final 100, you weren't really rewarded for it. And you, when you got to the final 50, you weren't really rewarded like I think you should be. So, you know, while first place was 1.3 million, the biggest ever for a $1,100 buy-in, I think that it could have probably been closer to a million and, you know, spread that out a lot.
Or even like call it 800, but like, I guess that's kind of the whole thing is like the marketing angle has always been like, how much is first? Like we saw it with WSOP last year with like being bigger than the Jamie Gold year. So it's bigger than the 12 million that he won.
It's like a marketing thing too, right? Like if you get close to a million, you're just going to make it a million. Right. So you can say, hey, it's a million to first instead of it's 925,000 to first.
Yeah, sounds and better. We've had that example many, many times, you know, even from like 10,000, 100,000, 1 million, that type of thing.
Right.
So you see that. And, you know, the media wants that. The tours want that. The TV wants that.
Of course.
It's a little bit surprising to me, to be honest. This far in, I feel like, and maybe I'm just a little misled, but I feel like that those gaudy numbers don't move the needle the way that the figureheads project that they do.
It just looks nice.
Yeah, like the difference between first being 12 million or 10 million at the main event, I don't think that's going to have any impact whatsoever on how big.
12.1.
Yeah, or like, I don't think that's going to have any impact on how big next year's field is.
It's not going to be smaller because first is less.
Right, right. Like, if you make more people happy, if you make the guy who finishes 101 happier because you took 2 million off the top, right? And moreover, if you make the guy who finished second happier,
like that disparity,
because he wasn't playing heads up for $6 million.
That heads up disparity is crazy.
Right? Like, that's insane.
Like, even Espen's year, when Espen won 10 million, second was 6 million.
Yeah.
And like, look at this. It was 12.
12 point, and 6.
It's 12 and 6 and a half.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right, so first got 2 million extra dollars and second got 500K extra.
Yeah. I mean, it's just. It's,
and the price pools are roughly ish the same.
It's really wild too, because it's especially punishing to the lesser professional players, because if you find yourself in that situation
gotta
where like
good heads up.
You're heads up, right? And you're against an established pro and you're just good. Like, you're a big dog now playing a $6 million match. Right.
Right. And, you know, I love the fact that they broke the record and had the biggest field and it was the event of the year on GPI. I think that it's incredible, but also, you know, I see your point of it. And, you know, you contacted me or put out a message even in our championship that should be flatter payouts. And I thought about it. I thought about what you said. And I think about, you know, what a lot of other people say. Matt Salzberg came to me and said he thought that, you know, he didn't get rewarded for finishing and, you know, 300th place out of 10,000 players. And so I went back to the drawing board and, you know, it's going to be another expense and it's a lot of work to try and create all these little numbers, but I think it's worth it because in the end, you know, we want the game to be sustainable. And I think that having these flatter payouts and having deeper runs get rewarded is a big part of that.
Do some people in the like industry or like as like a TD think that it should be what it is now for first is like a good, a good thing, or do people kind of agree across
there,
the board
there
it should
are
be a
some,
little bit smaller?
And there are some that have different opinions for different tournaments, like if there's multi-reentry or if there's multi-flights and multi-reentry. If you do a percentage like we do, 12.5%, you could literally be paying 25% of the field. Mm-hmm. If some, you know, if you had, like we recently had an event that had 750 entries, but there was only 326 unique players. So what percentage of the field got paid in that event? It was close to 26%. So, you know, if...
But you're just talking about individual humans, right? You're
right.
Those humans are averaging...
Yes.
X amount of buy-ins, though. So it's still kind of like if you treat the buy-ins as unique.
So there are some TDs that want to do 10% when you have multi-flights and multi-reentry.
Yeah.
And there's some that still want to stick to the 15%. There's some that want to go to 20%. So it's very tough to get somebody to say, I'm going to go and do what, you know, Savage or with the World Poker Tour and use their payouts unless they see something they really like. So I'm hoping that it is something they see they like and we can, you know, make it more of a standard,
yeah,
more of a flatter standard.
I feel like online has modeled this pretty well over the years.
Everything except WSOP.com.
Well, they're to be fair, they're kind of up against it. Like I know enough about their inner workings. It's not like they can just put a payout table in the software, right? They have to like guess field size, which is
sometimes it's just like fucked up spots. It is what it is.
Yeah. I know that you were involved in that conversation on Twitter a while ago. Not a while ago, maybe a couple of weeks ago, as was I and a few others, where they were arguing that paying 12.5% of the field is better than paying 15% for regs. I'd be curious to hear your take on it. We didn't really dig into it too much, but I just thought like a lot of the evidence that was kind of being demonstrated was just very flawed math.
I'm still a little confused by that video. I didn't really understand it, but there were some big names that were behind it and saying that 15% was better than 10 or better than 12.5. I didn't understand the theory of that, but I also... you know, it's an opinion, like put out a poll and, you know, while this is, doesn't mean anything, you know, when you put out a poll like that, you see that it's just about 50-50, you know, people
yeah.
want different, you know, they want 15%, they want 12.5, some want 10%. So it was really nothing that could clarify any situation. So you kind of have to go with what it is and go with what you've put forward and hopefully people like it. If they like it, they'll jump on board, but there's not, I don't believe there's ever going to be a standard pay. I really don't.
Yeah,
I tried.
That makes me sad. Well, you know, it's not about a standard payout. It's about a standard approach to the payout, right?
Right.
And that's, I think, the thing that we gripe about. Like,
look, it shouldn't be standard and like every tournament has the same payout structure.
Right. But it should be an approach. Like, look, we have too much time on our hands, so every year we pick apart the main event payout structure, or like the $1 million mystery bounty was another one where certain variables aren't being controlled for, and it's creating this large disparity. Like
500 you have, buy-in heads up match.
Yeah, you just like when you're playing heads up for $6 million, it's like something went awry here. Or when you're giving away $2 million mystery bounties, and then you know first place is like 800K, and the next closest mystery bounty is 250K. It's like we could be dispersing that money so much better. And to me, like that's the overall point of an MTT. It's that a collection of people earn some wealth, but not uniformly, right? You know, it's just like a slow, gradual stepping thing where, you know, there are ROIs available. But whenever it comes to creating these structures, it seems to me like we have a few things at our disposal that we can control for, and we have to figure out what we want to prioritize. Do we want to prioritize ROI? If so, then obviously top heavy is nice, right? Like the best players are just going to have the highest ROI, and it's going to be capped much higher than it otherwise is. But if we don't want to prioritize ROI and we want to prioritize like, call it like retention, keeping people in the MTT loop and acquisition for new players and things like that, well, then we just have to strike some sort of balance of prize pools that are large enough that draw people out and then payout structures that are flat enough that keep your break-even players around as long as possible. Like that's the aim point, you know? It's not about focusing on the biggest losers or the biggest winners. Those ROIs are going to reflect one another.
It's
right?
kind of funny in that way where like top heavy structures for higher ROIs is like the better players are more likely to win the tournament. But everyone knows variance is so ridiculous that you can't win a fucking poker tournament to save your life. So like even though your ROI is higher, you don't really get to materialize it.
You're going to call me out like that, man.
I don't mean you.
I mean,
but yeah, I mean, you talked about that and you talked about structures a little bit yesterday. I don't know if we're going to talk about that today.
Yeah.
You talk about, you know, the fact that all these recreational players want all of these chips and they want these long levels and
like the big stacks and all these things, chips.
And they don't understand how bad that is.
Correct. Yeah.
I mean, that's just something that I've worked with and dealt with and tried to explain over the years. I wrote a op-ed in 2011 about, are these deep stacks better for poker? And I still don't believe that they are.
Deep stacks being like longer early level play and then like ramps up really fast at the end.
Exactly. And that's why I'm doing this Savage Average tournament coming up at the Thunder Valley where we're going to have just start with 50 bigs and it's going to be 50 bigs every level. So there's actually no clock in that tournament. And so if people get eliminated, the blinds will go up.
I don't know if I'm in the minority on this, but like people were even saying like call it back in the TV days of WSOP where like people would have like chip stacks and like mountains of like the 100 chips and stuff like that. Am I in the minority of thinking like I want less chips on the table?
Yes, you are. Yes, you are. And you are right. It should be that way. It's so much easier for the dealers. It's not functional having all these chips.
Right.
And mistakes are made much more often in that. And
of course.
Counts are done incorrectly. And yet I still get harped on all the time. You guys color up too much. It's more fun if you have more chips. Matt Clark, I don't know if you know who that is, but he always is on my case. Look how beautiful that is to have all those chips, and he feels like it's going to revolutionize poker. More people are going to play if they see these big stacks. And it's, you know,
I don't know how much of an impact it has at that level, but there is a lot of allure to the Jason Mercier stacks of WSOPs and, you know, just having these piles. But you're right, like practically speaking, it's impossible. Whenever you only have 40 big blinds, but you have 17 barrels of chips, that's pretty annoying.
I mean, we even saw it at like the WSOP main a few years ago when Marchington had like queens versus tens where it was a miscount of the stack.
Yeah.
And like if you're calling 17, you're calling 21.
Yeah.
But it's like if you're making errors, or we saw in the GG Bahamas, right? They missed, like there was a chop or something, like there was a mistake. And
Yeah. I don't think it was a chop. I think somebody got awarded the pot incorrectly.
It was like a chop pot, but they gave the whole pot to somebody else.
Yeah.
But anyways, like just point being like, it's so easy to make mistakes, like less mistake possibility just has to be better. Where like more chips on the table clearly makes that be a function.
It's easier to count two chips than 200 chips.
Yeah.
But man. Yeah. It feels way better. Tell me about this Savage Average tournament, because I don't think I understand it at all.
Yeah, it's amazing. It looks amazing.
So it's going to be something new, something I've never tried before, but I've always wanted to try. And the theory was always that the blinds would go up when you hit a certain average of chips. So let's just say there was 100 players in this event. It's a 500 with 50 big blinds to start. Everybody has 50 big blinds. As you eliminate players, the average stack goes up. But once it reaches a certain level, it has to go back to 50. So in this case, you lose 17 players, the blinds will go up.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't go up until you reach that percentage to where the average stack comes back down to 50. So what's going to happen is in this tournament, and I'm curious about it, a little nervous about it, is that it's going to move along like a standard tournament early on, maybe even a little faster. But as you get into the money and deep on day two, there's going to be a lot of play.
Yep.
And so I think that, you know, is that better? Who knows? We'll see. A lot of people are curious to try it. I think it's going to be something that I think, you know, isn't for every tournament, but I think it's going to be something that you may want to try once a series to see if it works. But in addition to that, there is no clock. So it's going to freak people out that they're going to look up there and there's no clock. Basically, if players bust out, that's how you're going to do that. We are going to use a action clock from the start of the tournament to keep play moving so people can't just stall or anything like that. Another issue that's happening in poker these days.
Is there an advantage to stalling in a situation where there's no clock?
I don't know.
Right.
You'll have to tell me.
Right.
I mean, I actually would love to see you guys analyze this after we run one to see how that works and to see if it is a better system or a better way. But I honestly think that a 40 big blind tournament would be better.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be a little bit faster, but it's going to be a two-day event. And it might be a long two-day event. But, you know, again, recreational players like to play too, so. It's something that we've fought with forever, and it's something that I've fought forever, is having these big, huge starting stacks at the beginning of these tournaments that just keep people around, and then all of a sudden you look around and everybody's short stacked, and next thing you know, it's a real crapshoot. So this won't be that way, and I think it's something that we're going to try and try again. We're going to do it at the Summit Hard Rock as well during the WPT Festival there.
Yeah, like so the Sharp people are so aware of how much a max late reg is worth. when the stacks just dwindle down so fast. Right. Like you win two doubles when you max, or even win one, you're almost at average. You win two doubles after having a starting stack and you have 4x average, you're greater than an average stack. Right. And all you have to do is win two all-ins where someone play, call it, I played for hours and you just came in here and won two doubles. It must be nice, you know? Right,
exactly. And so in this tournament, you double up the first level and it's only registration for the first level. You're going to have, you know, 100 bigs when everybody else has 50. So how you play that is going to be really interesting.
How does the registration work? Because obviously the average stack continues in flux as long as people are registering.
It's simple. The registration is just open 2 hours. And you take breaks from 2 hours to 2 hours, 15 minutes.
I see.
And so...
So you could technically take a break, still come back to the first level.
Correct.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I understand. Yeah. I honestly, I love the idea of...
I'll be in Florida, so I'll play it probably. Yeah.
I like the idea of tinkering with structures, particularly like a little out of the box. I think people are a slave to the clock, and removing the clock from poker, in my opinion, would make it a far better product.
Yeah, the clock is really bad. Like if there's a different way to call it, get things over with.
Yeah,
that's what the clock is for, right? And the tournament along at some point.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You do need in the tournaments. That's the other thing that I fight all the time.
Got to end the tournament.
With people that will be unnamed today that will say, you need to have all these chips, you need to have all these long levels, and you need to have every single level in the tournament. And, you know, as tournament directors, we fight that struggle because not only is giving more chips bad for the dealer downs. Mm-hmm. You know, it requires more dealers.
Yep.
It requires all of these things. And it adds time to late registration, which for me, late registration is just way, way out of hand.
It was a great...
Late reg being too long?
Yeah, it was a nice courtesy whenever you had like an extra 2 hours.
People don't even realize that when I was the tournament director of the World Series in 2002, if you didn't show up on time, you didn't play.
Yeah. Right, yeah.
You didn't play. And, you know, Todd Brunson showed up an hour late and said, these tournaments never start on time. What are you doing? I'm like, you can't play, Todd. Sorry.
Yeah.
You're out.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
That would be strange to have one of those tournaments. You had to be there at the start. People wouldn't even know what to do. It would upset so many people because they're just so used
to it. It is very funny that this is like an industry that, like, there's a tournament, right? For other things, like, oh, a chess tournament, like, starts at this time, you have to be there. If you're not there, you lose your match. Right, here, right. Oh, like you can just like show up 8 hours or later. Like you can show up like the next day if you want sometimes, you know, still get 20 bigs and like, and you don't even do that, but you make money doing that. Like right. A max late reg, like that deep is like, even in the main, like you just, chips are worth more when there's less people in the tournament.
Yeah, if you want to look up Kenny Holler, did a whole analysis about how late registration like, is actually better.
You know what?
Bad. That's a terrible thing for us.
It's better for your hourly. It's worse for your ROI.
Right.
So there's always an exchange. You are paying
more
a penalty.
Variance, ROI roughly.
Yeah.
Close.
Whatever. I mean, it should be slightly lower. But anyway, there is a penalty or a price to pay, but you're also recouping it in other ways, especially like during a big festival like the WSOP where you have so many options of things to play. I think I agree that it would be nice to cut back on late reg. I don't think eliminating it is necessarily the answer. Much like re-entries, I think it would be nice
to
cut back.
You'd never get Berkey to play if you eliminated it.
Well, I'm not the target, that's for sure.
Along those lines too, I mean, how do you like when you're playing in a tournament and you signed up on time and you're there playing and because all these people are late regging, you get pulled off your table. That to me is a big problem, and it's become almost standard now in a lot of different venues. And I can promise you the recreational players hate it.
Oh, for sure.
The fact
for sure.
That they
for sure.
Showed up on time, why are they getting moved?
Yeah.
Because Phil Hellmuth wants to show up late to every tournament. Mm-hmm. And those guys are all like, nope, this is the best. This is the best way to do it. And because they say it, we're doing it. That's what we're doing. And it's to me, it's unfortunate, and you know, you always got the people that would show up late all the time. You can't start a late reg table. You can't bring us all to one table. But, you know, on the other hand, a lot of tournament directors for many years have said, well, then just show up on time.
Yeah.
If you want more of a random draw, show up on time.
You just don't want to be able to game things is the problem.
Right.
Like, you don't want to be able to look at the line and say like, okay, these are going to be I don't want to be at that table. I'm going to hop to the back.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So what that does is leads us to leave more seats open at the start of the table. So if those people that are there on time are playing four and five and six handed for hours, and it's not fair to them either. So
I understand what you're saying because the structure is calling for a full ring.
It's a six max.
But like, you know, as a poker player, I would be be happier.
Recreationals don't like that either.
I know.
Right?
I get
they
it.
Want the full table. If there's one seat empty, they're like, why are they not filling exactly. the seat? Yeah.
Okay.
I'm like, I'm enjoying the leg room here for
take,
a second.
I have to take a stance that everyone wants to knows and it's better for poker anyways. Can things just be eight-handed from now until the end of time?
We're working on it. We're working on the World Poker Tour. Yeah. We're doing that again, on all day twos. Right. The prime are eight-handed. And if available, a lot of the main events are going to start mm-hmm. eight-handed too.
Yeah, so. Starting
that requires more,
right.
like, more dealers, more tables, and everything.
Some, right. Like sometimes, right? Sometimes, like, it's not like sure there's some staffing issues, like for the prime, 100%. Like for the 1100 prime, there's just so many people you kind of have to deal with nine handed. Like, there's just so much. There's
we
a
can
staffing
eliminate
error.
10 handed. Start there.
Well, I think that's, never I think 10 that's handed. What's
there
happening,
has,
right?
There's never if been 10 handed, though, unless it's,
yes,
a WS, unless it's WSOP.
Yeah. Okay, well, that's a lot of events a year.
I get that, but I'd say we've had events that are 10 handed. We've had
in my time. I've been lucky that I never got to play them.
He's like, in the last 6 months, there haven't been any.
Well, I've never played 10 handed besides a WSOP, like small field.
Until you're in a bowling alley 10-handed with no AC, you don't know what the hell's going on, all right? You
abolish 10-handed. We hear it all the time. Abolish 10-handed.
I think the thing is, if you make 8-handed standard, then 9-handed becomes the new 10, and that's fine. Like, we can all adapt to adding a ninth chair, and then it becomes, like, really wild and egregious to think, like, oh, man, 90% of the tournaments a year are 8-handed. The other 8.5% or 9, but we're suddenly going to have 10. That seems like where we'd be able to draw a line.
Right, like having
standard.
11 would be like.
Right, yeah. No, we'll never do 11, correct.
Yeah,
we did 11.
I know.
2000.
Yeah.
Fallsview.
Four World Series of Poker.
Fallsview did it too. You they used to have no a special idea. Table in the back of the room that was 11 handed. Mm-hmm. It was wild.
Yeah, people don't realize.
So this final
the,
table
in the 2004
11-handed?
WSOP, there was 11 handed tables.
Yeah.
And it went from one end of the room to the other. We had. It was awful. Johnny Chan was out on Fremont Street on an eight-handed stud table, and they were playing 10 and 11.
Jesus.
Oh, my God.
And, you know.
People forget about stud tables.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Those are small, small
tables. Yeah, it was a disaster. But at the same time, we got it done, and, you know, it was big for the time. But I think, you know, the players these days, you know, there is a breaking point. People don't like playing six-handed.
Right.
But they are okay with eight. And there are some people that still like to play 10, believe it or not.
No, I believe it. They're nits.
The nitty, I was going to say, the nittier
they
are.
They like playing 10-handed.
Yeah.
You get a couple extra hands per round. You know, you pay those blinds.
I do think that, like, I don't know who to credit for this, but I think some of the best adjustments that TDs have made in the most recent years is being flexible between day one and day two and understanding that it's about slowing it down later than earlier. I know that Bay 101 used to have this structure. I loved it where it was, I think hour levels day one, 90 minutes day two, and then it became six max once you were in the money.
Six at 36. And it just literally went from 36 down to 12, like right away.
Yeah, yeah,
and it was so deep.
Yeah.
The final table.
Final table was always
two,
like
one. He was like, he had like 250 big blinds at the final table.
Yeah.
Incredible.
I love those like almost like hybrid-ish structures. You know, obviously I like the idea of going from like 9 to 8 to 6 if you're going to do a three-day event type of thing. I think that's great. But more importantly, I think it's about the clock. Like, I think it's completely fine while registration's open to run 30-minute levels. But I don't think it's fine to run 30-minute levels like anywhere remotely close to being in the money, unless it's just a straight labeled turbo event.
Right.
Right. So it's like, it's fine if you want to have these earlier fast paced structures, it's reentry, get people in and out and, you know, have a lot of churn. I think that's reasonable. But like, once we get to the point of the event where there needs to be some play, this is where like the 40-60 structure, I think, is really important, or the 60-90 structure if it's a main event type of thing. And I think that that's something that I noticed the most from change whenever it comes to these structures. WSOP is doing a lot of the 40-60 structures mm-hmm. now, which is, you know, obviously to correct for the massive amount of chips that you're starting with, because that number just keeps increasing. You know, it's not that long removed from my memory when we got 1-to-1.
Yes, dollar for dollar. Mm-hmm. And when I was at the World Series in 2002, 2003, and 2004, I did 60 minutes day one, 75 in the money, and 90 at the final table. And at the time, it was unheard of, but it made the structures that much better, even though it was dollar for dollar.
Yeah.
The structures were great. You know, they were all two-day events, small fields, obviously, mm-hmm. but it's something that I've done for a long time. Even, you know, with this turbo event that's going to be on the Voyage, it's 20-minute levels for day one, but it's our day two, right?
Right.
Mm. So that type of thing, you know, makes it you know, when we have those turbo flights on our Prime tour, we accommodate those people that want to get in last minute or can have a job that they can't come in during the day. But I think that, you know, playing to a percentage is something that people and TDs didn't understand for years. Oh, we're going to play 15 levels this day and 15 levels that day, where I've always played to a percentage. So it, you know, the average stacks are always balanced.
Right.
And it made sense. So, you know, it's just one of those things that, you know, has been an evolution over time.
Yeah, percent is something that can get like scaled out, right? Levels are just, oh, you do this because that's how many levels you should play, and then you go home. It's like, well, there's still all these people in the tournament still.
It also, I think, creates like almost like a satellite within the event, right? It's like, okay, well, this portion of the event is going to be incredibly fast, and you basically have to graduate through it to get to the real event. You know, and I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing, especially if you're talking about large fields.
Yeah, like we did the WPT 500 years ago at Aria when we did that, the first one, and it was playing down to 12.5%. We're in the money, but 5% advanced.
Right.
So, you know, you came back day two, you made a lot of money, or you made a, you know, decent score, and, you know, you were deeper in the money, obviously.
Like, I do think there's something really cool about the way that things have been, where the deeper you get at certain benchmarks, or call it maybe like, you make in the money day two in their big tournament, and like the time increases depending on the buy-in, right? On how long you want the tournament to last, right? And then you get the final three tables, and then you make it even longer. Like instead of 60 minutes, you make it 90 minutes or something like that. And then you get the final table, and then you can kind of not slow things down a little bit, but like call it heads up. Like when you get to that point, you can decrease the levels again because now there's only two people in the tournament and you're trying to get the tournament over with.
Right. Yeah, I've always been against the rollbacks, and that's kind of why I wanted to do this average tournament, because you know it's a forced rollback, right? Mm-hmm. It's a forced. The blinds won't go up until we lose a certain number of players. But you know, for years we had on the World Poker Tour, we had a forced rollback at the final table and a standard for the final table structure. And actually, Howard Letter created that. That was before I was even the tour director many, many years ago. But I was never a fan of that either. But
it's kind of cool. He played tournaments and directed them at the same time.
Yeah, no, Howard Letter. Yeah, he was kind of, you know, he had some say over the final table.
Yeah. I guess my last question with regards to the structure, and this is something that I absolutely think could be standardized, even though maybe people won't want to, is creating some sort of buffer that has to be in place between the last hand dealt and the first hand the next day. What are your thoughts with regards to late endings and early restarts?
I'm a fan of that. It depends on the venue. A lot of times if you're at a place where everybody's staying at the property or, you know, it's a small tournament, that type of thing, I'm okay with 11 hours.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it gives you an hour, 8 hours sleep each way, and then an hour buffer.
Yeah.
You know, time, something like that. I've always been fine with that. But I think when you get down to like 10 hours, 9 hours, it's not enough.
I mean, we were seeing some events a couple summers ago where it was like bag and tag at 2:45, restart 10 a.m. And it's just, it's just, you know, you're killing people. No. You're literally killing people when the money matters the most.
I'm fine with the 10 a.m. starts. I think that's fine.
Sure,
Bay 101, the event that's coming up, we're starting at 9 o'clock, which is unheard of, right?
And obviously.
It's unheard of. And there's a line out the door of people
in
the Bay Area to play.
People forget that you had to be on the Savage text chain to even get in the 2K back in the day.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, we had early signups and things like that, and limited fields. And those were the days. I loved it.
Yeah. Well, it's nice to be able to oversell a product. You know,
right.
You have limited space, and demand is just greater. Yeah. But I think the way the industry is shifting, it's really hard. And you know, maybe you can give your opinion on this, but it's really hard not to see that MTTs are the entry point for almost everybody who gets into poker now. And, you know, as a cash guy, I worry about that to some degree because it's difficult to lower the barrier of entry. You can't really make it smaller than 1-2 and still make the house profit. Like, and it's already difficult with how much the house is taking to have anybody even be a winner at 1-2. So the barrier of entry tends to be a little bit high from the cash side, and it's very low from the MTT side, whether you're talking about $100 dailies, where sure, you're getting raked over the coals, but like, you know, you win one and maybe you play a 500 and now all of a sudden you have you've jump-started the ability. But man, the field sizes, like that alone, it almost makes it more attainable to maybe not do it or maybe not as sustainable to do it for a career, but like it makes it attainable to get to a level of a score where you're just in the cycle for years.
right?
You know, you have an early 100K score, you might be a tournament player for 5 or 6 years.
And that's the balance too. I mean, the recreational side of it. If you have these small buy-in tournaments where the rake has to be high because you've asked for so many chips before, in the old days, you used to get 1,000 in chips and you'd be out right away and then you'd jump into the cash game. Yeah. That's what tournaments were for,
right?
Back in the day.
It's changed so much.
It's changed so much.
Really? They were that, what were they for? Were they for?
They were just loss leaders.
For cash
games. Yeah, we would just lure people into the cash games. It's like the best time to go to a local casino was whenever they were running their event. You didn't even have to play it. You just go start the 5-10 game knowing that it's going to have a list 100 people long.
Where, like, people just kind of played tournaments to go play poker and then...
Well, it was a lottery. You just had a shot at a big figure and like nobody cared. Like if you're not in the final table, no one cares, right?
Oh, I see.
It wasn't like this big 3-day grind. Like when
and then
we
it
first
became
started,
a profession.
Yeah, like when LeMann and I first started playing live events, we were playing one days at Seneca that were like, you know, $500 buy-ins and they would get 500 people. Just an absurd turnout for this little bingo hall in the middle of upstate New York. And then, you know, those 500 people would then spill over to the cash games.
Yeah.
And it was like, okay.
It was an amazing time in commerce. We had satellites going all day long, 20, 30 satellites at a time. And those just completely went away. And, you know, it's all about tournaments.
I think the milestone has a chance to bring satellites back.
Yeah, I'm a huge fan of milestones. Obviously, I had started this reverse satellite shootout type of satellite and taking the chip leaders out at certain levels kind of gave that a start of something that it creates an incentive to be aggressive in the satellites,
which speeds things along.
Right. And so, you know, some people are doing these milestones differently, which I don't like. They're actually taking, if you win a milestone, let's say the milestone was 100,000 and you won a pot that brought you to 180,000, they will take that 80,000 and
disperse it
amongst the table. And
defeats the point.
Poker Stars was the only one that I was aware that was doing that. I know they did it at PCA when we were there last, but, I believe they were looking to change that.
Okay.
I think that they understood that the way that the Wynn was doing it for the WBC Championship was better. Mm-hmm. To clarify, like the way that it works is if that's the case, then you just remove all of the chips and eventually you just have a real satellite bubble at some point, right?
Like, right. Yeah, and then you'd actually just play it out like a normal satellite.
So. Right.
But again, everybody's a little shorter because those chips have all come out of play.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I love that. I love the fact that, you know, makes that the case.
And yeah.
Those things along. Satellites we had at the Wynn last year, just incredible. I mean, just massive. I mean, there's, you know, groups of people that are coming back to be satellite players again,
right?
Which used to be a thing back in the day.
Oh yeah,
yeah, for sure.
Gone away. So now people are doing that again, and people are actually, I think, allowed or not allowed to re-enter if you've won that seat. And I don't think they allow you to re-enter at the Wynn, but they're talking about letting people re-enter once your milestone. So.
What are your thoughts with regard to that as far as like letting people?
I don't like it. I mean, I'm trying to get people into the main event.
Exactly.
So yeah. I don't really like that. But, you know, I see it happening. You know, if you've won a seat and then you play it again and then you wait till the last day to register, now you have two seats and things like that. So
it's kind of interesting because there's a give and take, right? Like on one hand, you don't want people to be professional satellite players for a couple of reasons. Number one, the ROI is incredibly high. Right, because you're basically making double your money, and a really good satellite player, with how bad a lot of people play, will cash at a higher frequency than they would like for the same amount of money in a traditional event. But number two, you have to now pit that against the fact that a lot of these events are re-entry, so you don't want to limit somebody to only one bullet.
Talk about that.
Yeah. You're at fault for this. You've done it.
When I started re-entry at the Commerce Casino in 2010 or 2009, it was completely a different thing to do. I did it as a $335 buy-in, 300 plus 35 with a million guarantee. Mm-hmm. And at the time it was unheard of that you could do this, but you could not re-enter the same flight.
Right.
You had to re-enter the next day.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it brought all of these people back to the casino the next day. And the last day we had 1,793 unique entries on 110 tables. So it was crazy. And I also started with 3,000 in chips. So.
Right, as it should. Mm-hmm. You got to get them back for 1B, 1C, 1D. Yeah,
exactly. And so it was just a massive event and a huge success. And the next thing I know, people were, you know, doing reentry the same day and multiple reentry. And it's gotten out of hand. I know that most people say that I travel to this event, I want to be able to reenter. And then you have those guys that have unlimited money that are just buying 5, 6, 7 times into an event. And that's also not a bad thing either. So you have to, it's a balance. You always think that you're going to burn everybody out of their money, but it seems like they keep coming back. So
they keep printing more.
Yeah. And the good thing is that there has been tournaments all over the world and all over the country. But I think at the sometimes we're going to reach a breaking point. I'm not sure when it is. There's a bunch of new tours out there right now that are putting big guarantees in these events, and a lot of them are missing them. And
yeah,
the fact that they're missing them, you know, tells me something. You know,
yeah, yeah.
Maybe there's a little too much reentry. Maybe there's a little too many events, too many.
Well, there's a tipping point somewhere always,
there
right?
There has to be. And I hate to see it. I want everybody to be successful. I love, you know, when the WSOP sets records. I love when we make guarantees for $40 million.
Yeah, it's you guys are the two industry leaders, and if you're willing to take big shots and have big hits, obviously that's going to spill out to every other aspect of tournament poker, you know, coast to coast. So there should be no rooting for one another's failure in this particular instance. Like, if the WSOP were to slap a huge guarantee on first place for the main or something along those lines and they miss it by a large number, that's bad. That's bad for everybody.
I wouldn't like it.
Right. I think with the reentry thing, I think largely they get it right, but it's a byproduct of having so many other events available. Like, capping it at maybe one per flight, I think is generally just pretty good. And I do understand, like, you know, I'm traveling to fucking Choctaw. Like, I don't want to bust the main event and then be stuck playing a $400 side event or whatever. But I think that the best thing tournament directors can do is, like, if you limit the reentries and then give them other events to play, everybody tends to be relatively happy. Like, you want to be able to spread that money as far as possible. But I don't know. I'm on your side. I don't know when it ends. You know, like, it's one of those things where if it were up to me as somebody who doesn't play tournaments all that often, I'd be happy to see everything go back to freeze out. Because I think that ultimately what it does is it keeps the pool more liquid. And it actually probably increases ROIs for people who get good. So I think, like, you know, there's something to be said about tournament poker in the late 2000s, early 2010s, where what we would now consider to be the high roller group was grinding. Like, they were traveling the tour. And I think that's really good for the health of the game, but it's a lot less incentivized now because the only reason to do it would be if you had just like an infinite ROI in some of these buy-ins and didn't have access to higher stake games. Like, these guys are going to play really, really, really high stakes games for such negligible ROIs. You know, Ike was recently on a podcast saying he thinks that high rollers are capped somewhere between 7% and 15% ROI. It's like, that's very small.
Right.
And it's a very tight window to hit, you know, like, if you're not in that window, well, then where are you? You're contributing to it.
Right. And to me, it all goes back to cash games because me as a tournament director, I'm a little different than everybody else. I loved it when we had a tournament at noon and then a tournament at 6 o'clock and you got one shot at it.
Mm-hmm.
And what you did after you busted, if you busted early in the tournament, you went straight down to the cash game.
Yeah.
And you played, and if you were a tournament player, you played cash games and waited for that tournament at 6 o'clock,
right,
and went back and played that one. If you busted that, maybe you played more cash or maybe you went home. But at the end of the day, that's why we had these tournaments. That's why rake continues to go up,
right,
is because the cash games are not doing what they used to.
Yeah.
And so you have to have the rake go up, especially when you give more chips at the beginning of the tournament because you have to pay those dealers and minimum wages have gone up across the country. So it's a delicate balance and it's tough. And, you know, I've been in a tough fight my whole career with tournaments because I'm always out for the tournaments and I understand that there's a balance with the cash games. It has to be there. And if not, you know, rakes are going to continue to go up.
Yeah, that's a whole other episode. I'm going to have McCormick on here and just like, I think cash games are just like so slow to evolve. So slow. And they don't understand how much they're shooting themselves in the foot because, you know, the dinosaur version of two blind poker, no ante, 8 or 9 or 10 handed, whatever. It's just like, it's not drawing people in. It's not interesting. There's a lot we can do to kind of change that. I'll end on a funny story that Todd Brunson told me about Sam Grizzle back at LAPC. So apparently he and I might be conflating two stories into one, but it's honestly fine if I am
not a news source.
Apparently he had been playing, I think, 612 stud, 600, 1200 stud. And he's winning in the game, has like, you know, 100,000 in front of him or whatever. And whoever is backing him comes and pulls him out. He's like, I'm not leaving, you know, yada, yada, yada. And he's like, wasn't winning much. He was up very small. So his backer pulls him and leaves him with his profit. And I think it was like one or two big bets. And Grizzle sits back down with his one or two big bets, runs it all the way up to like six figures, like 100,000 or something like that. Leaves, goes upstairs on no sleep, plays whatever the daily tournament was, won it for, you know, 80,000 or whatever, comes back down and was seen asking for cab fare like a day and a half later.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
It's like those are the stories that we just won't ever really have again.
Yeah,
for a lot of reasons. The game evolved. We
probably
matured as a community.
Good reasons.
Well, I don't know, Landon. You know, get a little fucking gamble in you, kid.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes you got to sit with one big bet and just pray. It's okay.
Happens in tournaments.
He didn't mean to leave a chip behind. That's all his backer gave him. You know, RIP to the legend.
The legend.
All right. Thank you so much for joining us, Matt. This Absolutely. Was great. If you guys want any more information on the WPT Voyage Cruise, hit hashtag Voyage in the chat, or you can click the link in our description. We'll all be there for sure. Matt's going to be there hosting some club party on the Cayman Islands, I guess. If you guys are into golf pickleball, yeah, or pajama parties, this is going to be the spot. We'll be back tomorrow, noon Pacific. Matt Hunt will be joining us for Strat Chat. We're going to be talking about overbets. We'll see you guys all then.
Peace.